Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Happy December the 14th. It is Thursday. We are just coming off a couple of spectacular days with our GAP campaign. Thank you to all of our listeners, all the people that love us and support us and care about us and financially open their wallets and say, yeah, I will help. I will help at this GAP campaign. And we had it and you did it. So thank you so much. We are now a little tired, but we're happy and thrilled, and we're excited about what God has in our future, and we're excited about what God has in your future. We're going to do our very best to help you nurture that and bring you along in your journey with the Lord by speaking the truth of God's Word every day here on Faith Radio. All right. Now, did you know on this day, it was a long time ago, 1799, George Washington, the very first president of the U.S., he died at the age of 67. And you wonder, do you ever wonder, how did he die? So I had to look it up because I was very curious. He was out on Thursday, December 12th, on horseback, doing farming activities from late morning until about 3 in the afternoon. The weather got really bad, light snow, hail, rain, the whole thing. And when he returned, it was suggested that he change out of his wet riding clothes before dinner. But he's so known for his punctuality that he said decided just to go to dinner in his wet clothes. So anyway, the next morning, another 3 inches of snow, a little bit of a sore throat. He didn't feel well, but he went to the hanging wood area on the east side of the mansion after the weather cleared to select trees for removal. That's what the president is doing. Okay. So he throughout the day, it was observed that his voice was getting worse. And by Friday evening, things were not good. So what does Mrs. Washington do? What does Mrs. Martha Washington do? Well, she concocts something for his throat. And it's a mixture of molasses, butter, and vinegar to soothe his throat. And his doctor said, let's do a bloodletting. So they took a pint. I always think when you're feeling bad, let's get out a pint of blood. That'll help. But this molasses, butter, and vinegar solution to soothe his throat. And then Martha also had a portion of vinegar and sage tea prepared for gargling. And then the doctor decided to take more blood. Anyway, to make a long story a little tedious, he died 2 days later. And aren't we grateful that we have the kind of medicine that we have today? We can sit and argue about healthcare and about the way in which it works. But boy, oh boy, we have some awfully big advantages in healthcare today, and that is awfully, awfully nice.
It's also kind of interesting to note that they thought they were doing good things.
Oh, yeah.
That doctor that removed the blood from George Washington thought he was doing good things. The wisdom of the age would say that. Sometimes the things that we think we're doing that would be perfectly wise turn out to be foolish in the end.
So there was a total of 32 ounces of blood was extracted. In that period of time, they also administered an enema. They're just trying everything. I go, thank goodness there's changes in medicine.
Happy breakfast, everyone.
Sorry. I'm just trying to report the information.
Just reporting the facts.
Yeah, and this is from George Washington's Mount Vernon website. So that's where I got this information. And so anyway, let's just all be grateful that when we have a little bit of a cold or something, or we come in from the rain, that we have warm clothes we can put on, and we have modern medicine that can help us get well.
Amen.
Amen to that. So anyway, we're going to take a little break, and we have Peter Capster, who has new respect for his students who are running late because he's on his cell phone this morning versus being in studio. So I will miss seeing him, but we're going to talk to him in just a minute.
Take off that gloomy mask, tragedy.
Yeah.
It's not your style.
No, it's not your style.
You look so good that you'll be glad you decided to smile.
Good morning. It's 9 minutes after the hour. Thanks for joining us today. We are looking forward to the Christmas celebration coming up in about a week. We're excited about that. And we're going to have lots of interesting things. We're going to have Ace Collins on tomorrow, I believe, and he's written, I think, 95 books or something. And he's written a book on the meaning behind the songs of Christmas, so that's going to be a great conversation. Looking forward to that. But for now, I have Dr. Peter Kapsner on our line. Good morning, Peter.
Morning, Bill.
So nice to have you on the line. Usually I get to have you in studio, so I miss you. So thanks for coming on board.
Yeah, hey, you know, I think I've heard in 15 years of teaching about every excuse under the sun about why a student is late. So I've been racking my brain to tell a story beyond the fact that, you know, my alarm just simply didn't go off because I'm a technological zoo, apparently.
Okay. Well, you are forgiven, and I'll just look forward to seeing you next week, hopefully. You know, I was thinking about language. Language is so important, and I always am very suspicious of agendas. When I think of the case in front of the Supreme Court right now with the Jack Phillips masterpiece Baker, I think of the fact that it is freedom of religion, freedom of expression. He's saying you can't force me to do something against my religious convictions. Peter, I'm curious about if you can force a baker to decorate a cake with a message he disagrees with, can you also force him to speak those words out loud? Can you make him say he agrees with gay marriage?
Boy, you know, it's so interesting to follow this case right now. And I think it's going to be precedent setting on a number of levels moving forward. And once you set a precedent that you have to serve certain people or you can't serve certain people or however you want to go about doing that, it does lay down the precedent that you can begin to control language. And, you know, we're, it is, I'm sure, too extreme to say, but it always calls me back into the George Orwell books of 1984, where at what point are you trying to control everybody's thoughts? And when will they be somehow antithetical to what we think is right in our culture, that we can't even think certain ways, much less talk or act in certain ways? And this is going to be a big deal, however this all goes down, that's for sure.
Isn't it part of the Communist Manifesto to try to get people to say words that they don't agree with, but just to get them to say them out loud?
Yeah, when we find that in a wide variety of life, don't we? I mean, you have subtle pressures in whatever social situation in which you find yourself, whether it be family or your job. School can be a place where you try to sort of co-opt the language of that place because you're nervous about what the reactions might be. And this is taking it into an entirely different level now at this point. When it gets to be society-wide in terms of how we are allowed to speak and a word can easily be taken out of context or out of an intended meaning, you really are seeking a different form of control that really is opposite to what so much of our freedom has been historically in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Peter, last night I was watching a little bit of news, and there was a guest on a program, and she was talking about a case at, I believe it was Harvard, where a guy was talking with his friends about a particular woman on campus he thought was attractive, thought she was kind of hot. And all of a sudden, he gets backlash for that because you can't have that kind of talk on campus because men are perpetrators of crimes against women. And when you talk in an inflammatory way like that, you are speaking out against women by even just saying that you're attracted to somebody. You think she's good looking, she's hot, whatever.
Yeah. Again, it's how far do we end up taking this? And you feel silenced on all of these things. And, you know, I get that part of it on one level, just the sense in which women have been so deeply objectified in our culture on so many different levels. So I can understand why in many settings some statements like that would be interpreted in the way that they are. But there's also, you know, at what point do we have a measure of common sense that goes with it, too, in terms of, you know, who's the person saying it? What do they intend? I mean, I remember thinking one of the girls in kindergarten was cute. And
right.
Is that at a point now? I don't know. It just gets to go to either extreme. We seem to live on either extreme of the pendulum swing. And it's very difficult to carve out an intelligent middle way in the midst of all of this.
I'm just going to call you out, Peter. You date teenage girls, but you did it when you were a teenager.
Yeah, well, it was like, what, five, you know? And I'm not sure I knew what dating meant. It was just, you know, I was sharing a truck in a sandbox. And I was,
right.
I know I went home that day pretty excited about that.
Right, right. I just hate it when we have to take a page out of the book of common sense and then put it in the book of rules.
Yes.
That makes
me
mental.
Having lived over, it does, me too, Bill. And it was one of the most freeing experiences that we had as a family is when we did live overseas for several years in Scotland. And being in a society that isn't so litigiously based, where everybody is suing one another and everybody is trying to power over each other, I had not lived in a culture where sort of common sense was just part of the deal. And, you know, I'll never forget my son Caleb when he was on the playground, when he was probably 7 or 8 and he was playing soccer with the rest of his mates over there in Scotland. And they threw him in the goal and he did a great job there. And then they let him shoot a few times and he would shoot. And if he took a bad shot, his classmates would say, well, that was rubbish. And go ahead and try again. And you can't even hardly say things like that in
right.
our culture over here these days. You know, to say that was rubbish is making this judgment call that somehow could ruin somebody's self-esteem for the rest of their life. And it was just different living in a society where people, generally speaking, treated each other with a measure of civility and kindness and weren't always worried about all the things that they said.
Yeah, Peter, let me take a little break. I'll let you continue to drive. It's 16 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. Peter Kapsner here from the University of Northwestern, and Bethel will be back in a minute. Welcome back. It is 19 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with us this morning. It is Thursday, and I get to speak to Dr. Peter Kapsner on Thursdays. Always look forward to that. And he comes into the studio. But this day, he is in his car driving quickly. So, Peter, what's with the size of an avocado seed?
Yeah, you know, I could have anticipated a number of questions this morning, but that was not among them. But I will say this, it is, you know,
it's like a squash ball.
It is, you know, and it's a digit-threatening situation whenever I am using avocados, because I'll slam the knife right into the middle of that seed, try to get a hold of it to rip
right.
it out of there. And, you know, so far I'm about 100 for 100 and succeeding with that. But
uh-huh.
one of these days I'm coming in with, you know, minus my pinky. It's a high-risk move with those things.
I agree. I just think that the seed is disproportionate to the fruit. Is it a fruit or a vegetable?
Really,
I don't even know.
That must be a Genesis 3 fruit, because you know that couldn't have been part of the intended garden thing, because it's really wonky.
Yeah. Okay. So what else do you have going on between now and the end of the year?
Well, you know, it's time for students to head into their finals, which is actually a very light time of work for professors. It's an incredibly stressful time for students. And so that really, they go late this year. Their finals are not wrapped up until the 21st or 22nd of December. So this time of year, there is this mad push for the students. And then at the end of that time, there's a mad push for professors to try to get everything graded before Christmas and turned in. So it gets to be a pretty busy time of year. I know tomorrow night I get to put on some fancy robes and go to graduation at Bethel with the
nice.
Students. So I might have to text you a photo of how amazing I look in those.
I do want to see that, because I need something new to make fun of. Say, Peter,
yeah, you know.
I saw an article in the Times, a London newspaper, about that it said that women are more unhappy than men. Ready for this? Until they reach their mid-80s.
Really?
Yeah, it says that women are more miserable than men for almost their entire lives and are happier only after the age of 85, which I think is obviously absurd. But that says that women
right.
get progressively happier in retirement before overtaking men in the 9th decade.
Wow. I'm going to watch this carefully. Hallie and I have been married for 23 years, and I'm going to you know, I need to have some sort of happiness thermometer in our house and just see how this goes. Was there any explanation at all by the Times for why suddenly you get happy when you're 87?
Well, right when it got to that point, it says if you want to read more, you have to subscribe. So that's when I ran out of information.
Oh.
Isn't that just the way it is?
Of course. Big shocker.
Yeah, big shocker. Yeah. I've read my 10 free articles for the month, just so you know.
I know. I love that. Yeah. And then it's like for $99.99, I can find out why.
Yes. Well, I'm not that interested. Yeah, so. I'm not that interested because I don't believe it to be true. So last night, I'm watching a little bit of TV before bed, and there was a story on, again, this is an ongoing story, and it will continue to have some dominance, but it was a guy talking about the way that Facebook and social media is consistently unraveling fabrics of our society. And he was talking about this this school in where you're only allowed pencils and pens and paper. And the school happens to be in Silicon Valley, and most of the students are children of computer and media kind of parents.
Yeah, I've seen some of these articles too this week, Bill, and the irony of that obviously is remarkable. The havoc increasingly that people are realizing that social media is creating for all of us, or young people in particular. They're using words like we're being reprogrammed, and that our entire sense of society is unraveling because of it. And so the very creators of some of this, I don't know if you saw the article, but one of the creators said he had great regret and he would never let his own kids go on social media. And that would be evidence, obviously, in some of the Silicon Valley classrooms you're describing.
Peter, always enjoy having you on the show. When are you back in studio next week with us? I'm just curious.
I would love to, Bill. You know, they're going to be in their busy time next week. I'll just be twiddling my thumbs. And so, I would love to spend some time in studio again.
Yep. And just before we head out, I want to say thank you for your consistent contributions. I just absolutely love having you on the show. And we just completed our 2-day Gap campaign. I don't know if you tuned in at all or had a chance to listen, but the overwhelming response from listeners was so encouraging. And they seem to really like Faith Radio, and they love the mission of the station. As we continue now, we were founded in 1948, and we're still going strong thanks to what God's put on our hearts and what our listeners are enabling us to do. So I feel very grateful. You?
Bill, it's been phenomenal. It really an unexpected and lovely surprise. And I did hear about the Gap campaign. And that was just really welcome news. Really grateful for that as well.
All right. Well, have a nice day, and I will see you next week.
Sounds good, Bill. Thank you so much.
You bet. Yep. Dr. Peter Kapsner will take a short break, and then we'll be back with more in just a minute. Every time we hear the music. Good morning. It's half past the hour. So glad you're with us today. We'll take a little break for news. Dr. Ann Rathbone Bradley is going to come on the show next. I just like saying that name. Sorry. Good morning. 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Listening well involves being others focused. Adam Hughes says more about this and what he's learned by practicing it.
There are certainly techniques for listening. However, I do think that motivation is the first thing that we need to cultivate in order to listen. And one of the things that I say is that what if we walked into a conversation and we thought to ourselves, this conversation is not about me. What if this is about the other person? What if I were to really focus my attention on what that person is saying, what that person is feeling, what that person isn't saying but is sitting underneath the surface? And what if I tried to make this conversation not about me? And I think if we kept that in the forefront of our minds, that the techniques might come a little bit more easily, but I do think that the reason why I'm so devoted to listening is because how much it's been personally transformative for me as a person. That it's taught me humility, it's taught me surrender, it's taught me curiosity, it's taught me that I don't know all of the answers, and that that I need to pay attention, because there are things that I'm missing if I don't.
That is Adam McHugh. If you want to hear that interview from start to finish, go to myfaithradio.com. Check it out, Adam McHugh. You might be wondering, hey, Bill, what do you do in your spare time? Oh, I'm glad you asked. Well, in my spare time, I'm trying to be president of the Ann Bradley fan club. So that's what I'm trying to do. Next up, Ann Bradley.
I hear from a lot of concerned parents who feel their teenage girls dress too seductively. They wonder how to deal with the issue of modesty when young ladies are pressured to show off their physical attributes. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Teens today live in a world of sexual innuendo, where outward packaging and presentation is all important. And if your teen jumps on the bandwagon, it doesn't necessarily mean that her character is flawed. It just means she might be following a fad. My advice to parents is this. Don't flip out when your daughter is just trying to fit in. Rather, calmly and consistently address the more important issue of modesty. Then, make sure she understands that your family values won't be compromised, no matter how cool the fad.
Get a free online parenting course called Tough Guys and Drama Queens at freeparentingcourse.com.
We're back. It's 23 minutes until the top of the hour. And Bradley is Vice President of Economic Initiatives at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. Always a guest I look forward to talking to. I would actually be president of your fan club if you'd let me.
You are honorary president.
Nice. I feel so much better already.
I don't have anybody ask me that question,
oh.
So throw it.
Well, no, I mean, our listeners love you, just so you know.
Aw, that's so nice.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you. And Minneapolis is right now has voted for a $15 minimum wage worker. They're calling that a victory for workers. I don't think it kicks in until 2024. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, it's this issue keeps coming up, and I think we really need to tackle it. This is one of those things that you've heard me say this before. I file under it sounds good on paper.
Indeed.
Because I do think it sounds good on paper. I think it sounds easy in that we are worried about people who have lower levels of skills and lower levels of education, which is what the minimum wage is targeted towards that demographic. And so we say, okay, we're just going to mandate that employers pay them more. And right now, the federal minimum wage is $7.25, I believe. So this is a significant increase. Again, sounds good, right? We're going to help people. We're going to double their income, perhaps. And until we look at the longer run and the consequences, so think about the position of the business owner, because this is not just one-sided. It's not just about the employee. It's about the owner. So the owners say this typically hits fast food restaurants, things like this. Say you're the owner of the local McDonald's, you now have an employment cost that's gone up by 25%, mm-hmm. 50%, depends on what they were made, you know, making before. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, where is that money coming from? Maybe they were going to renovate. Maybe they were going to hire more people for other positions, but now they can't.
Mm-hmm.
And so one issue is that often what we see is the people who receive the minimum wage often get their hours cut because the employer can't afford to keep them on in the same capacity. And so now the employer may have to do more themselves and this type of thing. But the other issue is that we tend to see prices go up. So McDonald's may have to charge more for different things because they can't afford to just make that money appear out of thin air. So I think the real long-term solution is to try to help people increase their productivity. Maybe they need more education, vocational training. I think there are other ways to help. I think we're called to do that. I just don't think the minimum wage is the way we do it.
Mm-hmm. And I know that the income inequality has become a pretty divisive term. I know recently, right before I think Thanksgiving, you were on Canadian TV, and you were talking about that. What kind of discussion did you have? I've not seen that clip yet, unfortunately.
Yeah, so it was a conversation about, you know, kind of what do we do about the rich? How do we think about, you know, what they owe. And this kind of gets to the root of your question, which is, do they owe people something because they're rich? In other words, is this wealth accumulation that, the people have at the very top, you know, the super rich, is it somehow evil? Is it somehow, you know, maybe even illegal or unjust? I think that's the question that's brought to the forefront. And my response to this is, if people are earning their money in a law-abiding way that also demonstrates integrity, you know, if they're trying to solve problems that ordinary people have by providing us with goods and services, then the wealth they earn is justified because we as consumers have given it to them, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Waltons who run Walmart are rich because we shop there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're demonstrating in our kind of consumer behavior that we like what they are giving us. My family and I, we love Walmart, right? Because it's a way we can economize on our budget, and then we have more for other things. And so, you know, but there are some people who are rich because they've exploited or they've, you know, kind of played the system or they've engaged in kind of lobbying and cronyism to try to kind of rig the game for themselves. So I think we need to be very nuanced in the way we understand this. But the Bill Gateses of the world and the, you know, the Mark Bezos, I mean, these are the super rich, and they've, for all I can see, most of them are doing it. They're getting rich because they've provided us with really big benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we want to live in a society that doesn't reward political favoritism. I think that's the key.
Right. And talk about the idea that reward is always relative to risk, and that there's something about the entrepreneurial spirit that says, I will sacrifice this. I will hock that. I will put my mortgage up, because I'm believing in this idea and I'm taking this risk, and then it works out and they become profitable in their business, and then all of a sudden we're mad at them.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, this is exactly, it is. It's kind of a very schizophrenic type of attitude. It's like, well, we want people to be able to be entrepreneurial and to make bets on their ideas. But then sometimes when when they get too successful, we start to worry. And I think it's an inconsistent point of view. I think we need to say, hey, and here's an example. My cousin, who lives in Washington, D.C., really wanted to open a restaurant. And it's a very expensive market to get into. I mean, you need well over multi-millions of dollars to buy a restaurant. And he just knew he couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, okay, I'm going to start a food truck. And he makes grilled cheese sandwiches. I mean, you know, it's very
nice.
Basic. And he's done really well, and he has a food truck. Now he has a couple of employees, and he's making the sandwiches, and people love him. But this is a really small business that's grown. Now he has two trucks. He can afford to hire a few people. But when he started, he's getting up at 5 in the morning, making all the sandwiches, driving downtown, doing everything himself. And so being profitable means he can expand his business. But what we need to realize is he took a risk. There's no guarantee that he was going to be successful, that it was the right product, that people wanted at the right price. It's all a big guessing game for entrepreneurs. You can know some things, but you can't know everything. And so when entrepreneurs get it right, we as the consumers are rewarding them with dollars, and that allows them to make even more investments. And this is what we call economic growth, so it's a really good thing. And I think you're right to say we have kind of weird sensibilities around this. I think we need to support people who are accumulating wealth because in a market-based system like the United States, it means they're giving us things we like and need and want. So that's a good thing.
So should the government be able to race over to your brother's food truck and say, hey, $15 an hour, everybody needs to get paid at least that?
Yeah, I mean, they do that. But I don't think that, I would actually go so far to say is that's immoral, because they are making a claim on his property rights and on his ability to make profits. And by doing that, think about what he has to do now. Now he goes back to where he started, which he has to maybe do everything by himself, or maybe he can only afford to pay people during the run, you know, for 2 hours a day instead of having 4 or 5 hours of an employee's support. So it really crushes small businesses. It really hurts them. And I think, you know, the idea of the American dream, right, is that we can start with nothing and we can make something of ourselves if we work really hard. That's the dream. And we don't want to crush the dream just because we have unrealistic expectations of what policy can achieve. And so, again, I go back to minimum wage, which is kind of really an attempt to solve the inequality problem, to solve the poverty issue, but it's just not good economics. I mean, it just assumes that this money, I think what we assume is that entrepreneurs have this bucket of money and they're really sitting on it. And we could just make them take some out of the bucket and pay people $15 instead of $7. When really what we see is that entrepreneurs are working on very thin margins. And when you chomp into that with a 50% labor cost increase, you're going to hurt people. And sometimes you're going to make them go out of business. And that's probably not what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look at the unintended consequences of this.
Yes, yes. I'm speaking to Dr. Ann Bradley, an economist from the Institute of Faith Works and Economics. If you have a question for Dr. Bradley, give us a call, 877-933-2484. We'll take a short break and be back in a minute. We are back. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. Ann Bradley, and Dr. Peter Kapsner just walked into the studio, only 42 minutes late, but nice to have you here with me. He stopped by to say hi. Usually he's in studio, but today he was on the phone. And I said that Dr. Ann Bradley was on the line, and he chimed in with something that I said, you have to stay and say that to Ann. So, Peter, tell Ann what you told me.
Yeah, so good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Peter.
We had some papers due this week in one of my practical issues class, and it was on economic theory. And I want you to know you were quoted not just once, but twice by my students in my class. And, man, I was name-dropping left and right then at that point.
Oh my gosh, that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, it was fun
that's
to
so
just read.
To
yeah.
Hear.
And to be listening on the way in and hearing just a bit more about this this combination of faith and work and how you guys there are sorting this out. It's such an important conversation for people that otherwise live oftentimes very disconnected lives between their vocation and their faith. And so the work you're doing, it was showing up in my students this last week. It was really exciting.
Oh, that's great.
Awesome. That's just so exciting.
So, Ann, as we get back to entrepreneurs and risk takers, then the entrepreneur says, I have enough resources to open up another location, perhaps. And so they build a business in a community. And what do? They employ people. So why do we have this negative attitude towards the people? And let's call them the top wage earners in our country. And we're always mad that they're not paying enough taxes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is being fiercely debated right now, right, with the tax plan and all this kind of stuff on the Hill. I think that we have, and I'm probably part of the problem here in terms of the mentality that we have about entrepreneurs, because I'm always, listing up Bill Gates as somebody. I mean, this is a mega entrepreneur. I mean, he started fiddling around in his parents' garage, let's face it. He didn't start as, this huge billionaire. He still is just a regular guy. He's still just a regular guy. Money doesn't make you, a superhero. But that's what most entrepreneurs are. I mean, if you look at the diversity of the size of businesses, there's a few Walmarts and Targets and Amazons and Googles. Those are the big guys. But most of the stories are local entrepreneurs like my cousin, people who start in their communities. They identify problems. They grow their business. And most people don't become Walmart. They don't become the top 0.01% of the incomers. I think we should be cheerleaders for them to do that, because if they're doing that, it means that, again, they're serving people in a very profound way. But really, most of these small business owners are not making, seven-figure salaries at all. They're just ordinary people like you and I, right?
Yeah.
They're doing something local. And so I think we need to support that because, frankly, if, going back to kind of what Peter was talking about, our biblical mandate is to work. And we're to be good stewards of the gifts God has given us. And how best to do that than to go into the community and say, no, there's no physical therapy clinic in this town. I'm going to start one.
Mm-hmm.
Or, there's no dentist office here, so I'm going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these services help people. And so I think we need to support that and realize how hard it is for an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could do it, right? I mean, it's a lot of risk.
It is.
Willing to put it all on the line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Steve Martin's take on becoming a millionaire. How to become a millionaire? First, get $1 million.
$1 million, right. Could somebody give me $1 million? It would be very easy.
Right.
This is really hard for people.
All right, yeah. Anne, how do we deal with, and I'm going to ask Peter about this too, forgiveness and trust in the wake of workplace offenses?
This is a tough one. And wow, what a timely conversation for this, given all of these scandals that are going on in different kind of forms of workplaces, a political environment, in Hollywood. You know, we have to know that it probably happens in other places. And so those are kind of extreme examples. But I think to bring it to our daily lives, most of us have felt hurt or wounded or you know, exploited maybe even by our colleagues in some cases. And how do we overcome that? My colleague Art Lindsley writes on this, and he talks really, I think, articulately about the difference between forgiveness and trust. And so, you know, we're called to forgive, and it's a very hard thing to do. We can only do it through Jesus. But then there's a difference between, you know, kind of should you trust that person again? I think you can understand the distinction between being able to forgive, but then not necessarily kind of getting into the same relationship you had with that person before, keeping a distance while forgiving and loving them. That's a very hard thing for us to do. I think it takes constant, you know, God-centered affirmation to be able to do that.
And can a business owner or somebody, you know, maybe a business manager, can they actually go with their employees and say, I think forgiveness is really needed here and necessary? Or is that going to be a situation in which there's too much blending between sort of the faith language of forgiveness and what's going on in the business culture? Mm-hmm. Is that something that managers can do?
I mean, I think it's certainly possible, but I think this is what we talk about a lot at the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics, which is that, you know, there's this secular sacred divide that we kind of, it's a mistake, you know? And so we tend to think we can't bring our values into the workplace, that a business owner can't run their business as a believer. And I think, you know, that's wrong, that God calls us to do that. So it's hard, Peter, to do this. And I think you can only do it if that's written into your values of your company from the get-go, so that everybody knows that you're running your business according to certain faith principles. And that allows you as a business owner or a manager to kind of say, hey, how are we going to have this conversation about there's been a sin here, there's been an offense, and we want to work it out so that we can have a productive environment going forward. I think it's a wonderful thing. I just think it requires the right environment and a very transparent one.
Mm-hmm. And we just have a couple minutes left. I'm just curious about how the tax changes might affect charitable giving.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, you know, I have a lot to say about the tax plan. We could talk about that maybe another day. But,
sure.
You know, there's some signs of optimism here in that, you know, reducing tax rates is a good idea. Just on economic principle, because it, all the things we just talked about, it frees up money in the economy for entrepreneurs, for business owners, but for employees to do lots of other things. So the more leftover disposable income that we have, the more generous that we can be. And we know for sure that private charity is more effective than federal charity and state charity. It just is, because we're closer to the people we're trying to help. There's less waste. There's less bureaucracy. So I think that if we can get some of these tax cuts accomplished, that really is going to be helpful for charitable giving, because more money is maintained in the private sector for people to, again, be generous with, to make investments with. And as you mentioned, entrepreneurship, we don't think about it as a form of charity. But what do we do when entrepreneurs are successful? What can they do? They can employ more people.
Mm-hmm.
So a more productive economy means more jobs. It means less, you know, homelessness, less people living at the bottom of the income distribution. So I think these are signs that are potentially positive.
Mm-hmm. I'm always encouraging people, if they feel like God is calling them in some way or encouraging them to do something entrepreneurial. I think it's one of the greatest challenges in life. I think it's, you know, one of the greatest experiences to go out and either, you know, succeed spectacularly or fail spectacularly. God is going to teach you something through both experiences. I think there was a friend that said what he doesn't want on his tombstone is, here lies Bill Arnold with his full potential fully intact.
Right. Right. And that's not our job. Our job is to just to go out and do God's work and And we think that that, I think, well, my belief is that we view that as only happening in the church. And
yeah.
It doesn't. It happens in the church and in the workplace.
Yeah.
So we're to risk it all if God calls us to.
And yeah. I got to run. Thank you so much for being on the show. I'll talk to you again, hopefully, in a few weeks. Merry Christmas.
Yep. Thanks, Bill. Merry Christmas. Thanks, Peter. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Thanks
Ann.
A lot. A couple minutes till the top of the hour. We'll be back and wrap up the big show. Have a great day, everyone. I will see you in the morning. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.